Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for tuning in to Belmont Buzz via Zoom. I'm Joanna Juvelis, your host, and today we are going to talk with a child psychologist from McLean Hospital who is going to give some guidance for parents about children during this coronavirus pandemic and managing stress, managing anxiety, just managing life at home in a very different world because so much was taken away from us so quickly. I'm pleased to have with us as today's guest, Dr. Catherine Boger. She is the director of the McLean Anxiety Master Program at McLean Hospital and the McLean School Consultation Service. Welcome, Dr. Boger. Thank you for joining us on the Zoom today.
Thanks so much. I'm pleased to be here.
Why don't you tell everybody a little bit more about yourself and how you got into this line of work?
Sure. Yeah. So I was a psychology major in college, and the summer before my senior year, I decided to do an internship working with children and adolescents and landed at McLean Hospital. So I worked as sort of a mental health counselor in one of the adolescent units and just absolutely loved it. I lived and breathed it that entire summer. I barely saw my friends and family and decided that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And so I ended up getting my doctorate in clinical psychology and then landed back at McLean, and that's where I did my own postdoctoral fellowship and have now been for more than 10 years.
Excellent. And I know that you're also a mother of, I forget how many children and their ages. Can you remind me?
Sure. So I have three little boys, so ages 8 and 5 and just about 18 months. So that a lot of energy at this time, and it has been quite an adventure. My husband is a teacher, and so he's teaching remotely. I'm working remotely, and we're homeschooling the two older boys and trying to keep the third one alive and entertained.
Why don't we start out by talking about adjusting to this new way of life, which pretty much was thrown at us overnight. Working from home, or remotely, kids, you know, staying home from school. And why don't we talk about how it's affected the different age groups? I'm sure your 18-month-old maybe doesn't really have quite a clue about what's going on, or maybe he does because he can't go to playgrounds, right? But you start with the age group that you think would, you know, benefit most from this program, you know, parents of the age groups you think need help during this time. Because maybe the younger kids, I'm certainly like the kids who are much younger, aren't being affected by this. But I think this will have long-term effects on other kids, and I'm sure you agree. So what age groups would you say are most affected by this?
I think what we're seeing is a huge range of reactions, even across different age groups. So we're seeing kids of all ages, anywhere from elementary, middle school, high school, some who are doing okay, some who are actually kind of thriving at this time. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we're seeing children and adolescents who are absolutely devastated, and then anything in between. So there's this huge, I think, continuum. If you're looking specifically at elementary school, we're seeing some children who actually are appreciating having more time with their family members. And I know my 5-year-old is loving being able to spend all this time with his big brother and his little brother. And I think at that age, there's less emphasis on academics and socialization. And at the same time, we have some children who are really bored right now and struggling with that lack of structure, and children who are just, you know, dying for more attention, pulling on their poor parents who are trying to work either remotely or are on the front lines having to go into work. And so, again, seeing that range even within elementary. As far as teenagers, we're seeing that many of them are craving time with their peers. They're grieving the losses of those end of the year events, whether it be graduations or sporting events or proms or other ceremonies, and really just feeling uncertain about the summer ahead and sort of lack of certainty around jobs or activities. And so I think that's been really tough. And at the same time, we're seeing a pattern where there are some teenagers, and this is true for children too, for whom some of the demands of life have been decreased right now. So for example, with some of the anxious children with whom we work, the demands of school, which can be really anxiety provoking, or extracurriculars, or sort of the pressures around socialization, or even, let's say, bullying that they've had to experience, all of that has been removed. And so we're actually seeing some children for whom there's some relief right now. I think what we're anticipating for those children, however, is that this coming year will be particularly challenging with the potential transition back to in-person schooling in the fall, or even this potential idea of doing some virtual and then transitioning to brick and mortar and back to virtual throughout the year. Those transitions, I think, will be particularly challenging. So we're sort of bracing for that. But, I think even in this, what's that?
Sorry. Well, why do you think the transition will be difficult?
Yeah, I think for children, let's say, for whom school is extremely anxiety provoking, so that is one of their anxiety triggers, right now they're getting to avoid that. So they're in the comfort of their own home and sort of their own safety net, and that gives them relief in the short term. But what it's robbing them is the opportunity to go into school every day, to practice being anxious and seeing that they can tolerate it and handle it. And the longer they're out and the more sort of comfortable that they're getting in the home setting, I think the transition back to school will be really hard. And even the anticipation of that transition back to school will be challenging.
So what is your advice to parents to help children who will have difficulty with this transition?
One of the things that parents can do is help children, so identify what it is that causes their child's anxiety, what it is they're right now avoiding, and finding some way to have them face those things. And so given the confines in which we're currently living. So for example, if a child has agoraphobia and it's hard to go out in public places and home feels like this, you know, very safe place, then as it becomes appropriate with social distancing measures in place, actually practicing getting out in public, or practicing, if school is a trigger, practicing driving to the school setting, continuing with some academics over the summer, even potentially reaching out to some school staff and having those school staff connect with their child over the summer, just to keep, to the degree possible, sort of structures in place and the opportunity to practice interacting and engaging with fears.
Let's talk about summer, since you brought it up. School will end soon, and there are some virtual camp programs, but there really aren't any so far. A lot of in-person camps have been canceled. Maybe they'll start up later in the summer, but for the most part, kids are still going to be stuck home, and parents might still be stuck home or might be heading back to the office. But What is your advice to families with the different age groups of how to manage children in the summer with no real structure still? It's going to be worse, right? It'll be worse if they're if you can't get them in a camp program that's virtual and have some kind of structure.
Yeah, I've talked to many parents who are facing the summer with a sense of dread. There's a lot of uncertainty in terms of what it will look like potentially with camps or with this just complete lack of structure. And so, you know, one of the ways that parents might want to think about approaching summer is, you know, we're moving out of sort of survival mode and into how do we just support resilience, because we know this is going to be going on for a longer period of time. And so really joining with children and teens and eliciting their help in identifying what could be some concrete goals for summer. And these might align with different developmental tasks. So for example, if you have a child in elementary school, maybe that child is really excited to learn to tie their shoes this summer or make a sandwich or ride a bicycle, whatever it is that kind of lights their fire, and identify those as goals for the summer and then map out a plan for how to help them achieve those goals. If it's a middle schooler, maybe they want to learn how to babysit. And I've heard that babysitting, you know, can take on creative forms right now. So for example, some pre-adolescents and adolescents are taking social distancing walks around their neighborhoods with kids, and that's sort of a form of babysitting. Or the middle schooler might want to learn how to cook meals for the family. For a teenager, maybe driving a car, taking an online course. It certainly would depend on the resources that the family would have, but I think it's an opportunity to help support autonomy in children and sort of their thriving and moving forward on something that excites them. And so you could sit down with them, help them identify what it is they want to do, and then figure out what structures you'd need to kind of put in place to make those things happen. I think it's going to be important as families to figure out what each family's own threshold is in terms of socialization, what that will look like, and then be really clear about expectations and not get into the temptation of sort of looking over one another's shoulders at what other families are doing. It's figuring out as a family what, you know, each individual family's comfort level is. And then I think another thing that family members are going to have to work out this summer are just the issue of masks. It's going to be hot, and little kids are not going to want to wear masks when they're sweaty outside. And so I think predicting that in advance, that's going to be hard, and doing some problem solving as a family. But I think sort of the undercurrent of what I'm talking about here is just the importance of communication and identifying that this is going to be a different type of summer. There's certainly some challenges, but how as a family can people come together and sort of identify ways to make this sort of more manageable?
Well, I think they're going to need to invent a mask that is sweat resistant and I don't know. Under Armour, hurry up. I don't know. That's a very good point. I didn't actually think of that. And it does get very hot. But as you were talking about all of this planning that families need to do, it got me thinking that, you know, this is very challenging for parents. It's challenging if you're a happily married couple. It could be challenging if you're not a happily married couple, a divorced couple. I mean, how is there help for parents in this situation? I mean, and, you know, I don't know. Does McLean offer programs for parents? I'm sure they do, but what if someone is like, you know, this is not only is this affecting children, this is affecting, you know, the parents too. So if the parents can't, you know, stay sane throughout all this, it's going to be more challenging, right?
I completely agree. And we often talk with the families with whom we work about putting on their own oxygen masks first before they, you know, when if the plane is going down, you need to put on your oxygen mask before your child. And I think now more than ever, that is true. I'll speak from my own personal experience. There's just no downtime as a parent now. From the moment you wake up, whether it's 5 a.m. or 6 a.m., down to your children's bedtime, it's just constant with switching sets between homeschooling and working and managing the household. And I think it's, and not to mention all the screens that, you know, for parents who are working remotely, the screen time, I think, can lead to a different kind of burnout too, that people are not used to experiencing in in-person work. And so I think many parents right now are feeling extremely drained. And so I think there are things that parents can do on their own. And then I think when it crosses that threshold where parents really feel like their distress has gotten so hard that high that it's harder for them to manage and to function and to do the normal activities they need to do, then I would absolutely advocate that they reach out for support, whether that be in the form of individual therapy for themselves or a parent support group. Certainly there are therapists who also provide parent guidance work if parents are having trouble with their children's or managing their children's behavior in the home. And so there are a lot of resources out there for parents. But I think in terms of different things that parents can do, I think in some sense they align with skills that their children can do. And so when I say, you know, parents should put on their own oxygen masks first, it's almost like they can, they're modeling for their children as they care for themselves and they can do it with their children. So for example, one of the things that I have recently heard about Brené Brown, I don't know if you listen to her or know of her work, but she was wonderful work. And she talks about this check-in that you can do with family members where throughout the day, you just come up with a system, whether it's like a 0 to 100 scale, and you say, like, where are you at right now? And it's an opportunity for a family member to reflect on where they are in terms of their sort of emotional resources. And 100 would be completely full and 0 would be completely drained. And if you realize that your partner, if you have a partner, for example, is running pretty low at like a 20 or 30, and you're running a little bit higher in that moment, then it's an opportunity to step in and support. It's also a nice type of language to use with children to teach them how to check in with themselves and ask for help. And so continually checking in with one another about how each other is doing, and then also providing opportunities for parents to label their children's emotions, but also label their own. Because we know from the research that just labeling an emotion will decrease the intensity of it. And so it's a nice opportunity to teach children to do that. I think when children talk about their emotions or when spouses talk about their emotions, it's really important to validate that experience. It's so tempting, I think, as parents to jump into problem solving mode and want to just, if our child is feeling sad, to fix that and make that sadness go away. But really in that moment, what can be often most powerful and helpful is to just identify, like, yeah, it's really hard and it's understandable that you'd be feeling sad or down right now, and just stay with them in that emotion. That right there can be one of the most holding and helpful things.
That's a really good piece of advice. And would that apply to all ages, when you say, like, listen and validate their feelings, does that apply to, like, all ages, you know, anybody from a child up to an adult, validating someone?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think if you think about your own life and how good it feels when someone is really listening to you versus someone trying to sort of quote-unquote fix the problem. So if you think about, if you're having just a really rough morning, let's say your Zoom link isn't working like mine wasn't just now, and you spilled your coffee on yourself and you're just feeling frustrated and down, and someone comes up and to you and says, well, why don't you just get a new Zoom link and change your shirt? Versus saying, oh man, that totally stinks, I feel you. I think, you know, with the latter approach, it gives you that moment to really feel heard. And so I think it doesn't matter what age anyone is, it still feels really good to be listened to.
What would you say are potential long-term effects of what's happening for each of the different age groups? I mean, do you think that, I know people say kids are resilient, but do you think that there could be any long-term effects with what's happening with, you know, this war against a virus and, you know, the future of these generations? How will it change them?
Yeah, I mean, we know that the research shows that the experience of mass disasters and economic recessions is associated with an increased risk for mental health disorders.
You won't be going out of business.
As kids. Well, sadly, I think as a field, we're going to have to gear up and really figure out how to meet the increasing demand. Already, the demand is outweighed the supply, and that problem is just going to get worse. We have children right now who are, as they've been quarantined at home, have been witnessing substance abuse, experiencing neglect and violence. And I think it's also important to note that, you know, minority and under-resourced families are facing even greater challenges, with a lot of parents who are serving as essential workers, families who are living in really crowded conditions and not having access to healthcare. So I think that we're going to be facing this mental health impact of COVID for months and years to come. And the interesting thing is, too, to think about is that, so on the one hand, I certainly have concerns about the long-term trajectory in terms of children and adolescents' mental health. And at the same time, not all children are going to experience this pandemic as a trauma. And so I think it's important for us to be identifying what are the vulnerability factors that lead children to be more vulnerable to developing mental health issues. And then what are the protective factors too, and how can we, you know, capitalize on those protective factors? So, for example, social support is a huge protective factor.
What can you elaborate on that? Can you elaborate a little bit?
Sure. I think figuring out which factors make children more vulnerable, and so, you know, basic factors you could think about are first sort of resources and living in poverty certainly puts kids at risk. But on a more day-to-day level, sleep is an important one. Nutrition, exercise, all of those things, if they start to go offline, can make children more vulnerable to challenging moods right now, and adults too. And so I think given that our lives right now don't have a lot of built-in structure, to the degree that we could build in that structure and have set meal times and stick to those meal times, have a set wake up and bedtime, and then really think about how we're incorporating some type of physical exercise or movement every day. I think I've been forcing/asking my 8-year-old to do bar classes with me, which is not his first choice. It's, you know, the two of us and a bunch of 70-year-old women all together doing this virtual bar class. But what we do notice is we try to be curious about his mood before and my mood before and then our moods after. And even if he kind of goes into it grudgingly, we both notice that it lifts our mood to do this class together. And so I think figuring out too, what types of activities we do that improve our mood, and then what types of activities we do that also can have a negative effect on our mood. So another example is a lot of people right now are spending a lot of time looking at the news. And while there's certainly a pull to do that, while life feels very out of control and that feels like one way to try to get some control is to get information, I think there's a balance. And when we cross a certain line, then it can really affect our anxiety level and our moods and our ability to sleep, even depending on what time we're reading the news.
Yes, the news can be disturbing. It really can. Mm-hmm. All right. Can you tell us about some of the programs that McLean offers that could help children and families who need help? I don't know if you know of any summer programs. I'm virtual for the time being.
Yeah, so we had the opportunity to move to virtual programming pretty quickly. So for example, one of the programs I run, the McLean Anxiety Mastery Program, we moved from in-person programming to virtual within a day. We had been doing some virtual work, so we had some practice. But in that program, we serve children and adolescents age 7 to 19 who have anxiety and OCD, and we are running fully on a virtual basis. And so that is certainly, and that will be running throughout the summer. So that's one opportunity to get support and help. There is the McLean School Consultation Service, and we have been working this whole spring with our various school districts all over Massachusetts, trying to support the staff and supporting their students as they do remote teaching. We've been putting out videos and handouts and really trying to think about what resources would be most helpful to support the folks who are supporting our students. And there's also a DBT program that is running virtually for children and adolescents.
What does that stand for?
McLean and dialectical behavioral therapy. Oh. And so this is for children and adolescents whose emotions tend to run high, and it sort of takes a longer time for those emotions to come down. So these children are learning about emotion regulation and sort of distress tolerance strategies. And so that's also another option in terms of virtual programming. The McLean website actually now...
You go ahead.
I was just going to say, sorry, this is the fun of Zoom. The McLean website actually has a page for all of the virtual programs that are available for child and adolescent, and it's just now a central call-in number. So you can call that number and then get triaged to the correct program according to your child's needs.
That's great. And these programs, do you have to have insurance coverage, or do people pay out of pocket? How does that work?
It depends on the program. So for example, the anxiety program that I run is a hybrid program that's partly insurance-based and partly self-pay. For the self-pay component, though, we do have scholarships on a quarter, half, three-quarter, and full basis. And that is true for the DBT program as well. There are also programs at McLean for children and adolescents that are completely insurance-based. So it really depends.
Are there any other online resources that you can recommend for parents that could help them during this time and help them manage their children during this time in their lives? Maybe a podcast or any other kind of online resource that's free?
Yes. So the McLean website actually has an entire page full of resources. They have webinars that you can watch, videos, articles all about sort of surviving and attempting to thrive anyway in this time period. The Child Mind Institute has a really helpful website with resources for parents. In terms of podcasts, I myself have been really enjoying the 10% Happier podcast. Wow. And also I had alluded to Brené Brown before, so I sound like her number one fan, which I probably am. But she also has a great podcast that came out recently, and I find that those are helpful ways for me to kind of fill up my bucket during the day.
Oh, that's good. Do you actually have time during the day to fill your bucket, Dr. Boger?
Not really. So that comes in the form of multitasking. So I listen to podcasts while I make dinner.
Well, I'm going to close with two final questions. One would be, what do you see as the positives of positive things that could come out of all of this? The new normal.
Yeah. You know, I have actually been thinking about that. And I think one thing that I've noticed is that, in a sense, the world kind of hit the pause button, and we're all so used to moving really quickly through life in a million directions with a lot, and now with so much technology, with not a lot of opportunity to just have downtime and sort of that white space for our brains to be bored or get creative. And so I do think that, particularly for our children and adolescents, even those who are homeschooling, there is more opportunity to just kind of be and not have all of the extracurricular structuring time or, you know, built-in activities every day, where kids can just practice being bored and being and figuring out how to use their imaginations and how to entertain themselves. And I think as parents, sometimes that can be hard to tolerate when we have children repeatedly saying, I'm bored, I don't know what to do, entertain me, I have My five-year-old always says, I'm hungry, I'm hungry. He might have just eaten a meal, but I'm hungry. And that's his cue that he doesn't know what to do with himself. And I think it's very tempting as a parent to jump in and try to structure an activity or sort of help decrease that boredom or fill the void. But I think it's an opportunity for us as parents to actually step back a little bit and both allow our children to figure out how to structure their own time and how to manage just some open space and time. And then it's an opportunity for parents, if we actually even have a moment in the day, to do the same.
That's good. It's funny. My teenager still does that to me. I'm hungry. I'm wondering if that's code for like, you know, I'm bored, or like you said, I'm bored, or I just want your attention, you know, but they're not going to say right. that. I'm just like, I'm hungry.
My husband and I have, when we're both in meetings, we know that it's going to be the same questions over and over. So we've just pasted a piece of paper on the door that says you can have fruit, because we know that that's going to be the question. I'm hungry. What can I have? And so instead of getting interrupted 50 times, look at the note on the door.
Well, that leads to my next question. What is your advice to parents who are working from home or even outside the home, but let's just say they're working from home and they have their kids at home, you know, 24/7. What is your advice to these parents? Maybe that's different advice for different age groups, but.
Yeah, I mean, I would first just validate that this is really, really hard. And there's no practice that any of us has had for this. So all of a sudden we're thrust into this new situation where we're supposed to be playing these different roles. And we don't really have a template for how to do this. And so I think my first piece of advice would be for parents to the degree possible, to go easy on themselves, because it's a lot that parents are being asked to do. And then I think finding ways, I know myself that I feel a lot of guilt during the day when I'm in a meeting trying to work and I have a child, you know, pulling on me, trying to get my attention, and I feel like I can't do either thing to the degree that I want to. And so I think trying to figure out what are small ways to, you know, fill our children's buckets. And so, you know, one thing that has worked well, at least for our family, is family meals, and really thinking about now more than ever is an opportunity to have family meals. The research shows that having 5 to 7 meals per week as a family has a significant impact on the family mental health, relationships, even physical health. And so it doesn't even need to be dinner time. It might be lunch in the middle of the day or breakfast, but really taking the time to sit down and talk and listen. And I think it's hard to do that because we're often switching sets right out of a work meeting into that meal. But I think finding some time during the day to have some interaction with your child. And for us, it's worked well to be meals. I know for other families, you know, going for short walks or reading together before bed has been helpful. But all that to say, I hope that parents can cut themselves some slack right now. This is tough.
Well, I really think that's great advice. And when you say cut themselves some slack, it just reminds me of in the beginning when all this happened. I have older children. I have, you know, they range from 22, 18, and 15. And but I guess I could say my greatest concern was the 15-year-old, and not having structure anymore and not being able to socialize with her friends anymore. But I was trying to keep some structure, maintain structure. And I know that was advice that you had, but it's very hard, like just trying to get her to go to bed at a certain time and get off her device at, you know, a certain time. That's been difficult. And like you said, I just, at some point I'm just like, okay, I'm just not going to fight it. You know, I'm just not going to fight it.
Right, for
our sanity's sake.
Yeah, and I think that can be a nice way to approach it, is to figure out what are the non-negotiables. So what are the things that have to be happening in your household for everybody to function? And then what are the negotiables? What are the things that right now we can kind of take off the priority list, just again to cut ourselves some slack. Because sometimes I can get stuck in battles around things that I'm like, does this, at the end of the day, how much does this actually matter for my child and for our whole family? So yeah, it's tough.
Well, hopefully things will slowly get back to somewhat, normal. I know it won't be normal for a long time, but I do think that people should, some of these changes have been good. Spending more time with family, spending more time at home, slowing down a little bit. That's been a good, I see that as a positive. And I hope that when we do get back to the rat race, that we can still have time with our family and slow down a little bit more. Remember this time when we're like running with like chickens with no heads. Packing it all in one day. There's always tomorrow.
Exactly. Yeah, that'll be the question. How do we hold on to that peace and carry it forward when life gets really busy?
It's such a pleasure to have you on. I hope I can have you on again.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.